Hey everyone, welcome to episode number 7 of the Zach Kuhn Show. Oh, we're cruising over here. Okay, my guest today is RJ Curtis. RJ is the head of CRS, Country Radio Seminar. If you've ever been to the conference, you know how massive of an undertaking it is. From the breakfasts, to the concerts, to the panels, to the evening activities. I mean, there is so much to oversee, so much to coordinate. RJ does it all. We talk about that. We talk about his incredible career in the radio industry. We talk about when he moved to Nashville and started writing for publications like All Access and Country Air Check. We talk about the history of radio, where it's going, where it's been. There is so much information in this podcast. I cannot wait for you guys to hear. Let's dive in. Okay, RJ, we are recording on the podcast. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
So I'm so excited to talk with you right now because, especially right now in the age of COVID, I've been reading so much about streaming is up, streaming is down, radio consumption is up. Some reports are saying, you know, they're unsure. Morning shows are getting extended. Meanwhile, iHeart's laying people off and, you know, advertisers are pulling out. I guess my first question is just quite generally, what's happening with listenership right now? Are people consuming radio?
Well, I hope they are. I mean, it Nielsen would tell you they are. And then in the last couple of weeks, I've seen studies. I didn't dive, you know, deep into them, but I saw one from Westwood One, which is part of the Cumulus family, and then another one from Cox, you know, stating that listenership is stable, if not increasing. So I hope that's true. You know, radio's last, you know, bit of domination is still in the car. And, you know, if people are not commuting, the assumption is that there's less listening going on in the car because people aren't driving around. According to the Nielsen study, that was debunked. So I'm hoping. I think people are using everything right now. And I'm hoping that radio and even streaming is a part of that.
Why do you think that is? Because that was sort of my initial thought, which is, oh my God, to me, it's early on, there were the reports that streaming was down, which were quickly debunked or at least came up. And my thought was, well, of course, because people aren't in their cars, they're not at the gym, they're not in places where they listen to radio. But it really looks like now it's kind of leveled out. And why do you think that is? Do you think people are just, you know, in the morning, they want to turn on, they want to connect with their morning host and the personalities and the playlists?
I think people are searching for a routine that they're used to and that makes them feel comfortable. So that may be part of it. I think a lot of the perception and even the reality of lower radio listening and just consumption of audio might have been more, and I'm theorizing here, I don't have any data to support this at all. It's just a theory that I have. But I think in the beginning of the quarantine, people were at home, their work routine was disrupted, and they had maybe a little bit more time on their hands so they could you know, utilize their curiosity and, you know, listen more, a little bit to a lot of different things, you know, that podcast that they weren't able to have the time to sit down and listen to, Netflix, right. You know, that kind of thing. So I think it was just sort of a big free for all. And then as people settled into the day to day of being quarantined, I think people are just seeking a normalcy, a routine back to like the way it was. So maybe it's settling down and back into that right now. Again, Zach, I have no data in front of me to support that. It's just a feeling and I could be completely wrong. So there's my disclaimer.
So what do you think? Like, I mean, you've worked at a ton of radio stations. You used to be an OM at several of them. I mean, you've got such a long career in radio. You've seen it all. You know, if you were working at a station today, how would you be advising your on-air personalities, your, you know, everything about it? What is the role of the radio station today to provide entertainment, news, everything else? How would you be balancing all of those things in this crisis?
Yeah, well, I think the key word there is balance. You know, I mean, I remember going through during my time in radio, there were several things that happened that required, you know, some specific and empathetic care and feeding for the listeners. The two that stand out in my mind I mean, we're going way back here, but in 1986 when the Challenger exploded, I remember I was on the air when that happened, doing a morning show in Los Angeles. And then, of course, you know, 9/11. And, you know, the approach of the radio station has to be very measured, because you don't want to, in my opinion, you don't want to go into this maudlin, funereal kind of mode. You have to be, you have to stress what radio does so well, information, and then balancing that with entertainment. I remember at 9/11, you know, I was in Los Angeles at KZLA at the time, and we had, you know, we were a very, very aggressively imaged radio station, and we had a lot of fun, kind of goofy things on the air. We pulled that stuff down right away. Just a matter of like measure, you know, metering good taste with information and the right tone. And we did a lot of, in the moment coaching of our air staff that day to make sure that they weren't being too light or flippant, or on the other side, being too, you know, sad. Of course, it was a very sad day. You can't get away from that, but just too much of that, because people are, they are still looking for a bit of an escape in addition to some information source. So, yeah, I think balance is the key there. And I think radio overall, based on what I've heard here locally, I'm in Nashville, so I think they're doing a pretty good job of it. With this virus and, you know, people being quarantined, I think it requires a lot of continuous updates, because it seems like it's a very fluid situation. And particularly right now, because it's May 4th, and in some parts of Tennessee, you know, things are starting to open up a little bit again. So there's a lot of information that listeners need right now to tell them where they can go and what the restrictions might be and how to handle that. So I think that's radio's, that's their role right now, as it has been forever.
You know, something I was kind of thinking about is I personally don't have access to an AM or FM radio outside of a car, which I'm obviously not in that often anymore. And that kind of got me thinking that, you know, right now, you know, the personalities and the curation of music and all of that is as important as ever. But does radio, you know, have to stick on the FM AM airwaves in order to connect? Can it try out other platforms and other ways of connection right now? Or are we seeing that people are still finding ways to listen to their AM and FM signal, even in this time?
Yeah, well, I think it falls into that category what I mentioned earlier, and that is that people are using everything, and what they call radio, it means everything. Radio, we just saw this at CRS in February. We did a study with Mark Ramsey, and we asked program directors and we asked listeners a bunch of different things. One of them was like, what do you consider radio? What's radio to you? And the programmers, you know, for them, it was AM, FM. For the listeners, it was everything that they listen to that delivers audio to them. Streaming, all the digital platforms, you know. So, I'm trying to remember your original question here. I'm not doing a very good job of that. But
I guess sort of broadly, what is radio? But which is super broad. Specifically, you know, does radio have to exist on AM and FM, or can the same personalities, the same hosts, the same curation exist on, you know, Instagram Live or Facebook Live or other types of platforms where you can still have that connection? But is the signal, you know, critical to what radio is and the format and, you know, the reach that it has? In many ways, yes, but it feels like in times like this, people are restricted from those different signals if your number one place to get is in a car. So, you know, how else, you know, what other platforms can they take advantage? You know, should they take advantage? Is radio stuck to the AM and FM formats?
Well, as a delivery system, yeah. I mean, that's all they have. Although I think that radio has done a really good job of coaching their talent to utilize those other platforms that you mentioned. I have seen a lot of Facebook Lives and Instagram Live, efforts by radio personalities. There's a guy that's in, I think he does mornings at WQNU in Louisville. And it seems like every morning when I'm just sort of getting going and going through my reading material, I read all the trades and everything like that just to kind of stay close. I scroll by him on Facebook, and he's always on Facebook Live at a certain time every day, you know, and I check in with him. So he's doing that. And I think that's great. That's personalities have been doing that in the last 5 to 10 years, broadening their reach beyond just their show on the radio station. They've been encouraged and coached to do that. And I think for the most part, they're doing a pretty good job with it.
So I want to get into some other things, but I guess lastly, what I'm curious about in this topic is, how have you seen single promotion or artist promotion happening with labels and everything? I mean, typically, obviously, the, you know, artists are on radio tour, they're visiting the stations at the shows or everything else. You know, right now, how have you seen artists and labels interacting with the stations?
Yeah, I think that's happening to a large degree right now. My label friends have told me that the amount of requests that they're getting from radio to have artists do, you know, Zoom meetings and Facebook Lives and, you know, the small acoustic shows that we've seen so prevalent on Facebook and Instagram Live, those requests are coming in more than ever right now. And I wonder, you know, I've wondered, will that be the new norm? Because in terms of economies of scale, that certainly accomplishes a lot with the artist not having to travel all over the country. Although right. One label head that I talked to recently said, that's an effective way for us to reach listeners and have radio stations have that personal connection with artists. It's an efficient way to do it right now. But moving forward, that's not what they're looking for. They want the artist to be in the radio station, in front of listeners, interacting on a personal level long-term. And that's just one major label executive that I talked to. The others may have a different philosophy on it, but I don't think that's slowed down. That's why I think radio has done a good job of pivoting and finding a practical, pragmatic way to still get their listeners in front of artists, albeit on a virtual level right now. And I give them a lot of credit, but I feel like the artists, you know, are all on board with that too. And, you know, unfortunately for a lot of artists, every artist right now, they're not on the road, they're not touring, they're at home, they're stuck just like the rest of us. So they have the time to do it, and I think they've jumped right in.
Absolutely. Okay, let's go back for a minute. So you're living in Nashville now, and you went to college in L.A. Are you from L.A. originally or the West Coast?
Yeah, I mean, I consider myself a naturalized Southern Californian. Okay, I was born in Philadelphia, but we moved around a little bit before I was 10. So, from the time I was born, Philadelphia, California, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and then back to Los Angeles, and that's all before I was 10. But I grew up in Southern California. My identity, my whole cultural, you know, background is very much steeped in the Southern California upbringing in the late 60s through the 70s and 80s.
Now, as you were moving around, I guess possibly you were too young, but were you tasting different radio stations and different hosts in each market? When did you first fall in love with radio?
Well, it was early. I mean, it was in Pittsburgh. Now, we moved to Pittsburgh when I was like 3 or 4. And I remember listening to my parents, you know, in the car and at home. They had always had a radio at the house. Listened to my first station that I ever listened to was KDKA in Pittsburgh. I remember that the jingle. I think they were a music station, and I believe they're Talk now because it's an AM station. And then we moved to Chicago, and I remember listening to Top 40 WCFL in Chicago. And then when we moved to Los Angeles, of course, you know, in 1969, this is like 1,000 years ago, of course, but KHJ, you know, that was why it was so fun watching, you know, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, because I believe like a best supporting actor or best supporting role nomination from the Oscars should have gone to KHJ because it was, you know, all through the movie. It was just, but it was so great because I remember hearing, you know, those songs and of course those jocks, Robert W. Morgan, the real Don Steele, Humble Harv, all those guys. So yeah, that my first, you know, I was always listening to radio, but my first obsession with it was listening to KHJ. When it was Boss Radio, you know, Robert W. Morgan was doing mornings then. I remember one morning getting through and being Morganized. I don't know if any of your listeners would recall that, You'd call up Robert W. Morgan.
Tell us.
Yeah. Yeah. So you'd call up Robert W. Morgan and, you know, you'd tell him, like, you know, you're feeling down or you weren't, you know, you had a bad week, and these listeners would call up and they needed to pick me up. And then he'd say, okay, well, zap. And he'd play the sounder, you know, the sort of, you know, electronic kind of sounder. And he'd go, you're Morganized. And that was sort of like, you know, that energized you. And I get through one day and did get Morganized. And it was amazing. Amazing. And of course, you know, you're hooked at that point, right?
And did you think then, you know, was it just this thing that you listened to and loved, or did you think then, oh my God, I have to work in this industry?
Yeah, a little bit of both. So I was obsessed with radio, and I mean, I had KHJ on all the time. It was on, like, my radio never was turned off.
What kind of radio did you have?
Oh, I had just this little, you know, plug-in thing, you know, in my room, and it was an AM/FM radio. This is before I discovered FM radio, and KHJ was on all the time. And then, then I got into middle school and moved over to the FM band, and the radio station I listened to growing up, that is the identity of my youth, was KMET in Los Angeles. It was an AOR station. And it was just a fantastic radio station, you know. But in middle school, I had a friend of mine, my best friend in middle school, and who ended up being the best man at my wedding. His name was Rick Minyard, and his father is Ken Minyard. Ken did mornings at KABC in Los Angeles forever. Legend, star in the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and just, you know, number one rated morning show in Los Angeles. So I got to know the Minyards really well. And, you know, just getting to know Ken was very inspirational to me. And just said, yeah, that, I mean, I was like 11 or 12 when I decided that's it, that's what I'm doing. And that my focus was singularly put in place at that time. That's what I want to do. I wanted to be in radio. I made up my mind then.
Okay, so how do you break in?
Yeah, well, you know, of course, you're 12, so, you know, I do know people. I've met many people in my career who were on the radio when they were 13, 14, 15 years old.
Sure.
In smaller towns, and they started, you know, cleaning like a janitor in the radio station. Well, I, of course, you know, it's a little hard to do when you're working in Los Angeles, the number two radio market in the world. But I went through high school, and all through that was very, very, you know, determined to somehow get into radio. But in my first year of college, I was taking, you know, a basic radio course, and I had a project, and I had to go to several radio stations and get information for this paper I had to do. So I left my name and number, and I said, I will do anything. I'll empty the trash. I'll do whatever. And I ended up getting a job as kind of a gopher position at KBIG in Los Angeles, which at the time was a beautiful music formatted station. I don't know if you ever remember or know of that format, but it was one of the most.
No.
It was like what you and I, what a lot of people refer to as elevator music. You know, it was just sort of that
background music.
Like, right. Some people call it Muzak, right? And,
right.
But it was like the number one station, music station in Los Angeles. So I got a job there just doing, I was titled a music line operator. Okay. So at KBIG, playing background music, they had announcers, they did live breaks like four times an hour, and they didn't back announce any of the songs they played because they were artists like, you know, Mantovani and, the 101 Strings and people like that, right? So people would call in and they'd ask, hey, what song was that just played? And I had the music schedule and all the books in front of me. And I was one of the several people on staff there that answered the phone and told people what songs they heard and what the artist was. And that was my first, job, getting paid at a radio station.
And did you think the goal, I mean, obviously the personality when you're younger is probably the thing that sticks out the most, but was the goal to be an on-air personality, or were you thinking, I want to be an OM or GM or you know, whatever title it is at the station?
No. Yeah, no, it was to be on the air. It was to be a disc jockey. No question. I didn't know enough about the business growing up. You know, I'd never been in a radio station until I got that job when I was like 17, 18. And I didn't know, like, there was an operation manager or a program director. To me, I'm just a listener. My whole knowledge of radio is what's coming out of the speakers. And I definitely wanted to be on the air. And for me, it wasn't so much about the personality aspect of it. It was really about music. It was about playing music and being around music and you know, just being exposed to all kinds of different music. And so, as I said before, the dominant station in my life growing up at the time was KMET in Los Angeles. And that was a, you know, freewheeling AOR station. And I wanted to eventually work at KMET. that was my goal at the time. And again, I had no idea, no concept really of how a radio station was structured. That's all I knew at that time.
Right. So now you're taking requests, right? You were saying it, and you're sort of like at the low level. When did you start climbing the ranks? What was the first time where you got that promotion or you got that thing that you felt validated? You were climbing through the ranks. You were moving up.
Well, you know, I was I hung out with the air staff all the time at KBIG. That's all I did. You know, sort of this thing that wouldn't leave them alone. And asking questions and how do I get this and how do I, you know, what do I do to get on the air somewhere? And one of the guys that was an announcer there was also a consultant, and he had a station out in the San Bernardino area, also a beautiful music station, which was the FM side of an AM-FM combo, and the AM was a top 40 station. Anyway, he was looking for part-time announcers out there. So I went out there and I auditioned on the air. And got a job doing weekends, and then I eventually got a job doing overnights full time. And then, crazy, 6 months into my time there, the program director left abruptly. It was my first experience with your boss, like, suddenly not in the building and never heard from again. It was, you know, they assigned me the job of program director. So I'm 20 years old and I'm the program director of this radio station, which was ridiculous. But, I was completely unqualified to be a program director, but you know, there I was.
So I think a lot of us, especially, you know, if you hang around TRS, if you're talking with the labels, we kind of hear these terms get thrown around: program director and, you know, an OM. Hey, you know, what is the real sort of, like, you know, what is the real job description of the program director and the OM? And, you know, maybe we don't get too into so many of these positions, but, you know, like what's the real description?
Well, for me, the job of the program director is, I got into radio a really long time ago. That job has morphed and changed many times over. But I think still the bottom line for the director of programming, the program director, is, as it was explained to me, and my approach to it was always like, we are responsible for everything that comes out of the speakers. Everything that listeners hear, we're coordinating that. We're in charge of that. We're in charge of how the personalities are structured, what they're going to say, when they're going to say it, how often they're going to say it, music, even commercials, just every audio function that comes out of the speaker, we program directors are responsible for that. And that's kind of the way it was explained to me at the time. Now, at the time, I didn't, you know, when I first got into radio, I don't remember a lot of OMs, but later on, an operations manager was oversight of the on-air product, probably the music and promotions and marketing as well.
So, I mean, if you look online and, you know, you bounced around between a ton of stations in your career, from, you know, Los Angeles to San Antonio to, you know, several stations in Los Angeles. What would springboard each shift? Like, how would you hear about a gig somewhere else? Would someone call you and try to poach you? How are you jumping around? How would you make the transition from station to station?
Yeah, I was with KZLA. I got to KZLA in October of 1980. They had just flipped the format to country, okay? And oddly enough, the same person who got me on the air was now working at KZLA as one of the air staff there. And he said, hey, they're looking for part-time people. And I was out in San Bernardino still. And so I listened to the station. They'd just gone on the air like as a country station like 3 days earlier. So I listened to the station for an entire like 2 day period. I wrote down everything, wrote down all the liners and, you know, all the copy and stuff.
Were you a fan of country?
No, I'd never. This is a crazy thing about it. I mean, honestly, I'm not making this up. I had never listened to a country song from start to finish until my first night on the air at KZLA. I mean, I just dismissed it. I'm 20 years old. Okay.
Right.
Now I know there are at the time and still there are 20-year-olds who love country music and grew up listening to it. I did not grow up listening to it. I dismissed it outright.
So, and you're on the West Coast, which, you know, has a little bit of that Bakersfield thing, but, you know, it sort of gets washed over.
Sure. I mean, I knew Buck Owens, and of course he was a household name anyway, because he just was a big music star and all that.
Right.
But so he called me up and said, hey, they're looking for part-timers here. So I did that. I got that gig, and I'm there for 7 years. And during that time, I went from being a part-timer to overnights to evenings to mornings to assistant PD to PD. And, you know, just in the 7 year period. And then a former boss, Bill Main, my predecessor at CRS, ironically, said, hey, KNIX in Phoenix is looking for a program director. And I told Larry Daniels, the operations manager there, and Michael Owens, the general manager, I told them that you might be good for this position. So, I mean, it was always by referral, you know? I mean, I honestly didn't like cold call a job. I just was lucky enough to be referred or reached out to. I know that sounds incredibly egotistical, but it's true. I never really applied for any job cold. It was always through a contact and network. That's why I think networking is so important, and that helps out.
Now, speaking of Buck Owens and KNIX, that was on Buck Owens Broadcasting, right?
Yes, KNIX was owned by Buck Owens. Their company still owns Cuz in Bakersfield. He owned KNIX. He bought the station in the mid-60s. And by the time I got to KNIX in 1987, it was already the dominant radio station in Phoenix. So I jumped on a very fast-moving train and a very efficient, like perfectly programmed radio station. And I've always referred to my time at KNIX, 6 years there, as that at the time was the equivalent of, you know, getting a Rhodes Scholarship in radio. You know, you were so fortunate to be able to work there because it was an amazing organization, and it started from the top. Now, Buck still lived in Bakersfield, and the day-to-day on KNIX was run by Michael Owens as the general manager and Larry Daniels, the operations manager. And I mean, I had worked in Los Angeles for 7 years. So you go into a situation like that and you think, hey, I've been in radio for, you know, at the time, 9 years, and I've been in LA for seven. I'm pretty good. You know, I must know. And I felt immediately how I realized how little I knew about programming and radio and how it really should be done successfully. And I'm so fortunate that I was able to get that job. And I'm really fortunate that I was able to hang on to it at the very beginning, because I was really in over my head when I first got there. And I give a lot of credit to Larry Daniels and Michael, who hung in there with me the first couple of years. Larry always affectionately referred to me as, quote, his project. I mean, they could have cut me loose during the first couple of years there, but they, I guess they saw something or just couldn't, you know, couldn't find anybody else to take the job. I don't know, but, I did hang in there, and I really grew. I grew a lot there, and my understanding of radio programming and just how organizations should be, structured.
What do you learn? Like, I mean, obviously it's such an art and it's such a skill. But, you know, I think when you listen, it maybe seems like it's so easy or you don't think about it because it just flows. But, like, what is, like, a skill or two that you really have to learn and hone in on in order to put together a professional radio program?
Yeah, I think it can. For me, you know, the music part of it, I had that down. I could schedule and edit music, like, with the best of them. I really felt a high confidence level. I feel like in the music selection process, we spent a lot more time evaluating music there. And I had never been involved in a station that had in-house comprehensive music research, not only on call out on Currents every week, but, you know, library testing. And I'd never been around that. That was incredible education. The other part at KNIX was just management. One was time management, which I was terrible at. I refer to myself still as a recovering procrastinator, you know. But so I was just awful in that regard, and they had a high level of organization there, and that was great. And the other one too, from a programming standpoint, I know these are not like product things I'm talking about, but they're very important for, you know, programmers. The other part was this, you know, collaboration between sales and programming, because the famous, you know, butting heads of sales and programming over the year, they didn't have that. They worked stuff out. You were required to work with the sales managers and find solutions and find ways, you know, to generate revenue on the radio station and still preserve your programming integrity. And those are just three things that I learned so well from Larry and Michael. It was an incredible environment, a very challenging one. And I learned from Michael Owens how to dress for success. I mean, that guy was, man, was he a great dresser. And we were required at KNIX back in the day, then we wore ties and suits to work. It was, you know, it was crazy.
There's a whole new meaning to a good face for radio.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, for sure.
So there's so much, you know, history of you in the radio stations that, you know, I feel like it's almost a shame to jump over, but I really want to get into a whole bunch of other stuff. So how do you end up in Nashville? What brings you to Nashville?
Yeah. So we're going to flash forward here. I end up in Nashville, in 2009. And at the time, I'm the country editor for Radio and Records magazine. I made the jump from radio to, covering radio in 2007.
Now that doesn't exist anymore. I mean, it was owned by Billboard, but I mean, right. I sort of know it peripherally, but I never read it. I mean, what was that kind of the big trade magazine for radio and the space?
It was, you know, it absolutely was. In fact, on the masthead of the magazine, which it was actually a newspaper. It had newspaper and newsprint in it, but it was formatted like a magazine. And it was called the industry's newspaper, and that's what it was. It had an amazing stellar reputation. So after I left KZLA in 2006, when they flipped formats, I was contacted by R&R. Well, actually, a couple of people hooked me up with Erica Farber, who was running R&R at the time. Of course, I knew Erica, and the timing of it was just crazy because I had left KZLA and concurrent with that, like within that 2 or 3 week period, Lon Helton had left R&R. He had been at R&R since 1983 as the country editor, and he left to form Country Aircheck, and they were looking for another editor. And so there I was available, and we got put together. So I started in late 2006, and Billboard had just purchased the magazine in the middle of 2006. They eventually ceased publication in 2009. And like very shortly after that, they ceased publication. Skip Bishop and Butch Waugh at Arista at Sony Nashville, Sony Music Nashville, reached out and they said, "Hey, how would you like to be part of our promotion team? We think you could, you know, we think you'd be great at that." And so that started the move to Nashville. I was working the Midwest region, but I couldn't do it from the West Coast, obviously. So they moved me here in 2009. And I was with Arista Nashville for 18 months. And then I didn't take to promotion like I thought I would. I didn't love it. I did fine at it. I mean, I did my job. I got ads, you know, all that. I just didn't love the job. And I miss writing. I miss writing about radio. So Lon and I got together, and I ended up working with Lon at Country Air Check starting in 2011. And I stayed there till 2013. And then I went over to All Access, working for Joel Denver, covering it until 2018 when I joined CRS as the executive director.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening and hope you're enjoying the show. Some of you may know that I run an industry newsletter called the Nashville Briefing. It really takes you to the front row of everything happening in our industry. And if you want to learn more about it, you can go to nashvillebriefing.com to subscribe. Also, if you're enjoying this show and specifically this episode, please feel free to give us a 5-star review on your podcast listening platform. Thanks so much. Now back to the show.
Okay, so you leave the radio world, you spend a little bit of time in promotion, but then you're at R&R, you're at All Access, you're at Country Air Check. So while you're writing, you're now in the writing news world, were you missing the radio world at all?
I wasn't. it's crazy to say that because, I already told you, I decided I wanted to be in radio when I was like 11 or 12. And when I got into radio and understood what it was really about, like what it really means to be in radio, I did. I married that. I went into it marrying that career, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer. I really did. I was like, I remember, and it's hard, when you first start out, it's a hard business and it remains a hard business your entire career. Some people, are so in love with radio and radio doesn't necessarily love them back. Right. But you go into it and you're just dedicated to it. And that's what I thought I'd be doing for the rest of my life. And I was ready to do it, but situations come to you and they present themselves. And I'm fortunate. I was just willing to, try something different. And by the time I got to R&R and then sort of got out of radio, I got a broader perspective on the business. Because when you're at a radio station, particularly when you're programming, you are really, you're looking around and you're looking what other trends are and whether, what's happening in the format. As you get older and in the business longer, you do take a look around and see what's working in other places. But by and large, your head is down. You're just like, you're dealing with your staff and your station and your competitive challenges in your market. And when I got out of that, I was really able to, poke my head up above the clouds and look around and, have my head on a swivel. And it was like, wow, there's a lot out here that I could, be writing about or learning about. And, I remember going down to Houston in 2007 I was with a record friend of mine. And we were going to do the MS-150 bike ride. We're going to ride from Houston to Austin to raise money for multiple sclerosis. Okay. And anyway, I went to visit KKBQ, programmed by Johnny Chang, a friend of mine. And I the first time I'd been in a radio station in like 9 months, and I thought I remember walking into the building thinking, I wonder how I'm going to feel walking into a radio. Am I going to miss it? Am I going to walk in thinking I wish I was doing this? And I didn't.
Right.
I felt like, okay, well, that's what they're doing and I'm doing what I'm doing. And I didn't miss that. So I thought it was healthy. I did. I really felt like, oh, that's good. I don't, I'm not having anxiety or the grass is greener on the other side. I had moved on and I like being in radio stations. I like being around radio people. Personalities, program directors, salespeople. I like the people in radio, but I didn't wish I was doing it.
Okay, so how do you become the head of CRS?
Well, so through all of these years that we're talking about, and starting in 1985, I started going to CRS, and very quickly after attending CRS for the first time, I became involved in just helping out with things. Like I used to help the agenda committee back then by doing room counts during sessions. They wanted to know how many people were in the room at the beginning, the middle, and the end of a CRS session so they could track, you know, the engagement, whatever. And so I did that for a while, and then I got on the agenda committee in 1997 and 98. And all during this time, Bill Main, who I mentioned before, who took me to my first ever CRS in 1985, Bill Main was on the board of the board of directors at CRS, and he was trying to recruit me, and he nominated me several times to be on the board, and I've never made it, and I was never voted in by the rest of the board at the time. But I finally was voted onto the board in 1999, and I started a 20-year run as a CRB board member. And I was asked to be on the executive committee within a year and a half of getting onto the board. And in 2003, I was elected president of the board. I was president of the board for 3 years and then on the executive committee afterwards. And then I chaired the Hall of Fame committee for 10 years during my time. And then it was the, after I was the president, I was the vice president, oddly enough, for my time from like 2008 to my joining CRB staff in 2018. So I was very, very close to operations at CRB. When I moved here, I became much closer to it because Bill and I, Bill was the executive director then. He and I have been, he's a huge mentor and shaped my career in so many ways. And since I was local and I was a VP and he was the executive director, he bounced ideas off me. And when you're with the executive committee, you're very involved in the financial and just the business operations of the organization. So I was very, very involved in that, engaged. And, you know, I just loved being on the board. I loved being in the organization. I loved the event at CRS. And so I just sort of gravitated towards it. And it was a very good marriage. You know, I was for a while a member of the Academy of Country Music Board of Directors and the CMA Board of Directors, and for a very short time was a board of director member on all three, CMA, ACM, and CRB. I chose to remove myself from those other two because I was just so passionate, and I just felt like I was doing a lot more and helping a lot more with the CRB board. So during that 20 years, I was very involved in the evolution and the business, you know, decisions that we made. And so it was when Bill decided to retire, I did step up. I did apply for that job. That's one of the jobs I did apply for. And fortunately passed a very rigorous process of choosing their next executive director. It's the hardest job I've ever had to get. The process was like 6 or 7 months long, several deep dive interviews. And I mean, to come out of that on the other end as the executive director was really amazing. And I do not and have not taken that for granted one day since.
So, I mean, CRS is over 50 years, right? It's existed it's such an iconic institution in country music in Nashville, and it's always very cutting edge. It's always, you know, pushing the forward, pushing the boundary, you know, staying as relevant as, you know, as possible. And, you know, this year was your first year where you fully took it over, 2020. You know, first of all, I imagine there was a lot of pressure. And then, you know, how are you making sure that, you know, it was staying relevant and current, and that, you know, how are you thinking about how to put the whole thing together?
Well, you rely on your staff and your board and your executive committee. And in terms of the content of the curriculum of the event, you rely really heavily on the agenda committee. And I think we had amazing leadership on the agenda committee for two consecutive years through CRS 2019 and 20. Judy Lakin was our agenda chairperson, and she is just an incredible leader and rallied that group. And they came up with a really aggressive, progressive agenda for 2020, and they pulled it off beautifully. And the staff, you know, I mean, look, I had been part of CRS, very closely involved with it for 20 years. But when you get into the building and, you know, kind of behind the curtain, so to speak, you get together with the staff, and they had all done numerous CRS events as a staff, and I leaned heavily on them. We just changed a little bit of the infrastructure and our planning and organizational workflow and task management for CRS 2020, and that worked really, really well. But yeah, you just have to be you know, a big collaborator and rely on the great people in the organization, and that's what I did. Of course, I brought some thoughts and some perspective from the outside to it, and I think that worked well. I'm very proud of CRS 2020. I mean, when Friday night after the CRS New Faces show was over, you could really finally take a deep breath. And I remember the next day after the next day after CRS, you have a board meeting, and then you're sitting in front of 30 board members, and they're all just sort of talking, like sort of break down the events, like what worked, what didn't work. And then, and only then after that, I remember driving home and thinking, that's like the hardest thing I've ever done. It is. It's like, like when it's all said and done, you just take a step back and you go, holy crap, how did we do that? That's a huge undertaking. And it's an amazing moment. And it's such a proud feeling to pull off something like that when it goes well.
And then, I mean, I guess now things are a little uncertain, but do you start working on next year right away? When do you start working on next year's conference?
Yeah, we started, you know, CRS was over on the 21st of February, and we all took a couple days off, and we got back on the 26th, and we started working on CRS 2021. Now that's the way it works. And so in the month after the 6 to 8 weeks after CRS, you spend a lot of time evaluating, looking over data. We sent a questionnaire to attendees. We looked at all the feedback that we had on the CRS app, and just kind of breaking down like what worked, what really worked, what didn't work. In staff meetings, we break out on a weekly basis a major part of CRS and just deconstruct that to see what we can do better next year. For example, registration on site. How does that look on site? How do we service our attendees? Were they able to get their packets and get checked in early enough? You know, these, you break it down into the grains of sand, the million, billion, trillion grains of sand that together make up CRS. That's really what it is. It's a million, trillion little pieces, and you break down each one of those pieces. And so we really, in normal circumstances, which certainly we're not, you know, in that right now, but you spend, you know, March and April really just tearing it apart. And then you pivot and you start working really on building your agenda committee and getting those people together. And that's where we're at right now, even though we're working in kind of a virtual situation right now. We're on point. We are on schedule. We're not behind. We're not like letting things go by the wayside or getting lax on everything. Everybody's working remotely, but they're still on it every day.
Are we still planning for 2021? There hasn't been anything announced yet to move that or cancel that. We're still aiming for a physical conference in 2021, God willing.
Yes. I mean, yes, absolutely. It would be, I think for many people, very disappointing to not have CRS occur. And we are planning. I mean, we are going full speed ahead and working towards it. And the only thing that will stop us will be some kind of, you know, incredibly serious health crisis as we have now, where the government, you know, says you can't gather, or the hotel is in a situation where they're not able to accommodate any events. For example, the Omni, our host hotel in Nashville, is currently closed, and they will be closed through May. So, and we feel for them because they are our partners of ours, and the staff there is amazing. Everybody from the head of the GM of the hotel to the person who cleans the rooms is services us and our attendees in an incredible level. And we hate the fact that all those employees are furloughed and not able to work right now because they're our partner. And so We hope they're back to business and back to normal soon. And we hope a lot of this, we got so lucky because CRS happened really 2 weeks before this whole thing really took off and got serious, where people were working from home. So we really lucked out, and a perfect, you know, best case scenario for us would be if this whole situation occurred inside the window between CRS 2020 and 2021. I hope that happens. Right. I mean, CRS is an important event. It's important to us on staff and the board and the organization for sure. But I know it's an important event to the industry. If people look forward to it, they get a lot out of it. There's learning, there's networking, there's entertainment, there's rolling out of new artists and songs and projects. And it's an important event. And I would hate to see it interrupted in 2021. But we're moving forward as though it's going to, and that's what our plan is, and that's what our staff is doing every day right now.
Right. I remember 2 years ago going to my first CRS. I just moved to town and thinking this is the greatest city in the world, because I think in one day I saw Blake Shelton, Kenny Chesney, Tim McGraw, like every famous person ever play at like the Big Machine Lunch Alone. I mean, it's such a fun event, such a cool kind of industry insider thing. It's definitely one of the things that makes Nashville special and such a unique community.
Agreed. 100%. The thing that makes CRS so special and so amazing is it are the attendees. I mean, obviously there's all the people, the stakeholders in our business are there, but the attendees that support it and show up enthusiastically, they're the reason we do it. And it's all about them.
Absolutely. So any big picture goals that you hope to accomplish with CRS while you're running it?
Well, I think CRS, it is country radio seminar. Our core business is radio. But as we talked about at the very beginning of this, radio, what people perceive as radio is broader than it ever has been. It's not just the AM/FM band. It's streaming. It's satellite radio. Internet radio. It's all those things are considered radio. And I think that the big long-term picture for us at CRS has to be, broadening our appeal, broadening our curriculum for everybody who provides audio consumption out there. And not at the expense of radio, AM/FM radio, but just because there's so many options out there for people to use audio and to find, discover, and enjoy country music. And we have to be inclusive in that way. And I think long-term, and it's one of those things, it's going to take us a few years to get there, because if we just flipped the script on CRS and turn it into a digital conference, I think it would be way too fast and would alienate a lot of our core constituents. But I think we have to get there, and we are moving in that direction. As an example, on our board, which has 30 members of it, we have 3 members who are in the DSP sector of our business. So Brittany Schaefer is from Spotify, Ryan Reddington from Amazon, and Deb Herman from Apple/Shazam. And we specifically created those seats on the board to bring those people in that industry sector onto our board and help us get to this broader place where we're headed. And, we just have to get there, because if we end up being just a true, strictly radio conference, I believe it will get smaller, not bigger.
Sure. Well, RJ, this has been such a pleasure. And like I said, such a crazy time for radio, obviously, among everything else, and to sort of get a little bit of insight, see what's happening right now, talk about your history and talk about, the future of CRS and everything. It's been such a pleasure. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk, and hope we get the chance to do it again soon.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a ball. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I'm honored.
Absolutely. So one last thing. So if someone wants to break into country radio today, I mean, I think that, Bobby Bones is almost like the Taylor Swift of country radio, in the sense that you see Taylor Swift, you want to pick up a guitar and write songs. You listen to Bobby Bones, he might be, the biggest champion of radio right now in terms of, out front personalities. If you're that kid listening and you go, oh my God, I want to be a personality, I want to break into radio, what advice do you have for them?
You know what? My first advice is try out radio. You know, we have a lot of people on the, you know, let's say somebody in their teens right now, like a lot of people, like I said earlier, a lot of people like my contemporaries in the business started in radio as teenagers. And teens and college students right now and people that have something to say and that are entertainers and have a great personality, you know, now there's a lot of different platforms for them to choose from. Somebody that's really, really extra special and awesome could be a TikTok or an Instagram influencer star and make a lot of money doing that at a very young age. And we've seen a lot of that. But I feel like radio is still an incredibly amazing art form to be a great personality on the radio, to hold court, you know, for 4 hours a day and be terrific is a unique and magical skill. And I would encourage people, you know, on the young end to just give it a try. There's still a lot of college radio out there, and there are some programmers now in our business for years who have gone the unconventional route in recruiting talent. You know, they've gone from digging in their box of, you know, air checks and listening to guys who already work in radio to looking at people who are influencers and are just, you know, we went through a period in our time where we were recruiting, you know, stand-up comics to be radio personalities, and I don't think that really went great. But we have gone unconventional, and I hope radio continues to do that, but I hope the younger end tries out radio and seeks out the opportunities to be on the radio, because we need dynamic, incredible entertainers. You mentioned Bobby Bones. Look at the different levels that that guy brings to the table. You know, he can sing. He's a comic. He's a TV personality. He can do a radio show. That's a wide skill set that Bobby brings to the table, and it's impressive. There's a lot of other people out there like Bobby that can do that thing potentially, and I think radio should be part of that portfolio of skills.
What makes a great team? Like, Bobby's got Amy. He's got Lunchbox. He's got such a great cast of characters. You know, how does that come together? I mean, I guess, you know, you listen, you sort of get a sense, but what makes a great team? I mean, Howard's got his, you know, like everyone, you know, the legends always have their teams, it feels like.
Yeah. Well, what I understand about Bobby's team, and you got to love it, you know, Lunchbox, I mean, he hired off the street, just to our point
right
a minute ago about, you know, going unconventional. Amy, I think, worked in a restaurant or something. They just hit it off. They got along well. They could converse well. And, you know, that's a very important first step, someone you can communicate with and relate to. But then I think, you know, and a radio consultant by the name of Steve Reynolds told me this years ago. He worked specifically with morning shows and teams, people who work together. And, you know, he said a couple things that are necessary in a room like that. Number one is respect for one another. You know, everyone in that room has to respect what everyone else in that room brings to the table, and it's all different things. And you need different types of personalities in that room to make it interesting for the listener. Because if you and I are having a conversation and we agree on everything, well, that's not very interesting to someone. It's interesting to you and me. We like it. I mean, I love when people agree with me. It's awesome, right?
Sure.
But if someone is listening to a conversation between you and I and we agree on everything, well, there's not much there for them, right? But if we're either not arguing, but if we're disagreeing, then there's some substance there. And that's what Steve Reynolds always taught us to say. Opposites create meaning. And I think you have that in a room like Bobby Bones and all the really good shows. There's people that are, you know, Howard Stern is very different than Robin. Right.
Right.
But
oh,
they respect
absolutely
each other. They respect each other a lot. You can tell. And of course, they've worked together for so many years. They love each other. There's, you know, you can see that when you watch Howard and Robin together. They don't always agree. They go back and forth. I think those are some elements that are really important in a dynamic team element for a morning show or afternoon show or whatever. You know, the respect that those two people have, or three or whatever, in that room is incredible. And opposites create meaning, because people are eavesdropping on that conversation. There has to be something in that conversation for a lot of other people to, you know, to want to keep coming back and feel compelled.
Absolutely. Okay. Last question. I promise. What radio do you
sure
listen to right now?
Yeah, I'm a notorious button pusher. You know, I'm terrible about that. But, you know, I have a bit of a routine. I defer to the country stations in town because even though, you know, starting out in country radio, I had never listened to country music. I've been in it now for almost 41 years. And I did love the format. I love the music. I love the artists, the stories, all that stuff that people, you know, those words that people use when they talk about why they love country music so much. So I got to start with local radio. I love local radio. So it's, I'm going around the horn, listening to the three stations here and sometimes even WSM AM on the AM dial. Then I'm just all over the place. I mean, I love Lightning 100 here in town. It's an independent rock station.
Great station.
It reminds me, honestly, it reminds me of growing up listening to KMET in Los Angeles, and that it seems loose. And I hear stuff on there that I wouldn't hear anywhere else. And some of it, I don't even know what it is, but I like it. So I like that. Sports talk for sure, but I haven't spent a lot of time with that right now because we don't have sports, unfortunately. So, I'm just all over the place. And then I bought a new car in December and it has Sirius XM in it. And for the first time ever, I became a Sirius XM subscriber. And I say, I just love it. You know, I love the highway. I love Willie's Roadhouse, man. I could spend hours listening to that station. I like the Beatles channel, classic vinyl, the blend. I'm all over the place on every dial that I'm on. And I that's a lot of fun for me. Just zipping around the dial in the car and trying to get as much different input as I can.
It's awesome. Well, RJ, thank you so much again. I hope we get the chance to say hello in person whenever that is, whenever we get out here, and looking forward to CRS 2020.
Thank you so much. I mean. Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. I also look forward to meeting you in person, but 6 feet away. You know how that goes.
Absolutely. Well, stay safe, stay healthy, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you.
Hey everyone, thanks so much for tuning in. Hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you did, you're in luck because we release new ones every single Tuesday. Next week, we have an amazing interview with Robert Deaton, the head producer for the CMA Awards. I learned so much from this interview, from behind the scenes stuff to Nashville history to managing his band, King Calloway. It was a masterclass. I can't wait for you guys to hear it. Make sure you tune in next Tuesday. The Zach Kuhn Show is mixed by Sam Heyman, and our theme music is by Justin Johnson. If you want more content from us, you can subscribe to our newsletter at NashvilleBriefing.com, or you can follow us on socials, everything at Nashville Briefing. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll see you next week. Bye.